Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's headline that 50% of the population, that's half of the people in this country, have only 1% of America's wealth. The Washington Bureau Chief for Alternet, Adele Stan, joins us to discuss Ann Romney's Marie Antoinette moment, where she told ABC's Robin Roberts that we've given all you people need to know about our financial situation and about how we live our life. Then, as many celebrate the terrorist bomb that killed members of the Syrian dictator's inner circle, we will look into the double standard in terrorism, where many prominent Americans from Newt Gingrich and Rudy Giuliani to Governors Rendell and Howard Dean have taken money from the Iranian MEK, the MEK, designated by the U.S. government as a terrorist group. Jeremiah Gulka, who has an article at the American Prospect, Caught in a Bad Alliance, joins us to discuss Israel's and the neocons' favorite terrorists. Then we'll look into the worst drought since 1956 that is devastating corn and soybean crops and causing the price of corn to go up more than 50% in the past 4 weeks. Purdue University agronomist Tony Wynn joins us to discuss the impact of the drought on food prices and food security. Then we'll explore the global impact of droughts in the United States, Russia, the Ukraine, and Australia on global prices and the availability of food. Eric Holt Jimenez, who is the Executive Director of Food First and the Institute for Food and Development Policy, joins us to discuss the geopolitics of drought that could lead to instability and revolutions. And just before we begin, I'd like to invite you to the UCLA Hammer Forum that I'm moderating this Tuesday, July the 24th at 7 p.m. on drones and robotic warfare. We have three of the leading experts on the civilian use of drones, the advancement of robotic technology, and the ethical issues and implications. Again, this coming Tuesday, July the 24th at 7:30 p.m. at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood, free and open to the public. Join me. Joining us now is Adele Stan, the Washington Bureau Chief of Alternet.org, where she covers Beltway politics. Her work has appeared in The New Republic, The Village Voice, The Nation, Salon.com, and Mother Jones, as well as on the op-ed pages of The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, The San Francisco Chronicle, and the New York Daily News. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And I don't know whether you caught this morning's ABC Morning program with Robin Roberts, where Ann Romney was asked about her husband's tax returns that he has refused to release. And Robin Roberts basically said, you know, why don't you just show them, you know, and move on? And Ann Romney replied that we've given all you people need to know and understand about our financial situation and about how we live our life. Am I reading too much into this? It did seem somewhat like let them eat cake.
It does have that feel, doesn't it? My colleague at Alternet, Tana Ganova, she described it as an ice queen quote, an aristocratic ice queen quote. But talk about tone deaf. I think Ann Romney doesn't really have a sense of how aristocratic and dismissive she sounds in, you know, making that quote. And there is some dispute as to whether or not she said you people or just people, but I listened to the audio a few times from that interview, and it sounds like you people to me. So that's the piece of it, Ian, that's getting all the attention. But what she said right before that, I think, is really, really interesting, because as you said, Robin Roberts asked, why don't you just release them, right? And Ann Romney replied, before she had her you people moment, she said, because there are so many things that will be open again for attack, and you just want to get more material for attack. And that's just the answer. And then she goes into, and we've given all you people need to know about our financial system, our financial situation, how we live our lives. So she basically showed part of her hand now, didn't she? There's stuff there that...
Well, they showed a hand, but not the income taxes, which have been something of a tradition, ironically started by Mitt Romney's father.
Right.
But it's just that this comes on the day of the headline that 50% of the people, that's half of the American people, have only 1% of America's wealth. And
right.
I'm just having, you know, I'm starting to have these beam me up moments here because some of it is so amazing. The hubris of running a 1%er for president of the United States after the 1% took the global economy to the brink of extinction in 2008 and have been rewarded since. And the disparity in wealth has only grown in this country to the point where half the people in this country only have 1% of the wealth. That's a new version of the 1% versus the 99%.
But as long as they can blame it on the black guy, Ian. You
well,
know?
they're doing that, but I find it extraordinary that in this context and with this reality of who these people are and the idea of Ann Romney being the first lady is you know, I mean, she's going to make Nancy Reagan look like a pauper.
Warm and fuzzy. Yeah. A woman of the people.
Exactly.
She can get out there and entertain us on her
right.
dressage horse.
Exactly. Prancing around on the million-dollar steed. So, anyway, in spite of our conversation, which I'm afraid may be missing to most American people, because the latest polls indicate that Romney's head neck to neck in some of the key swing states, particularly Virginia now, with Obama, and the conventional wisdom is it's because the economy is going down. So is that how it is? It doesn't matter who the other candidate is. If the economy is going down, they're going to elect whoever this person is. Is that what we're really dealing with here?
I think we are dealing with some of that. I really do. I mean, I think that you have on either end of the spectrum, of course, you have certain immovable, right, contingencies, people who would never vote for Romney and people who would never vote for Obama. And, of course, the game is always for the people who are in the middle. And I think that, you know, liberals often forget that there are a whole lot of white people who voted for Obama reluctantly, you know, suburban voters, and who are susceptible to this message that it is Obama's fault that the economy is where it is. I mean, you know, there's some reporting out of Michigan where people whose economic lives were saved by the auto loan program that Obama put forward don't even, you know, give him props for that and aren't going to vote for him, even though it put them back to work. So I think that there is a real danger of that. But I also think that the polls, there's a lot that the polls are not going to tell us this time, because I think the makeup of the electorate will be different than it was last time around. And the polling models that we're working with, that the pollsters are using, are based on last time's election. So if Ralph Reed turns out more evangelicals this time, and Obama isn't able to get in as many young people as he did last time, and young people are having a tough go, then it could be, you know, even closer than we think.
Well, but given the kind of I guess, brash and kind of almost contemptuous way that that Romney's dealing with his refusal to release his tax returns, particularly over the years that he was supposedly not running Bain, 1999 to 2002.
Right.
And the fact that he released what he did release was pretty incriminating. He paid less than 15%. Apparently, you know, I mean, the assumption would be that whatever he doesn't want to release going back 10 years would be even more incriminating. But I wonder, you know, where the outrage is, whether the American people are simply just numb to it all, and that the money that's pouring in can basically numb them further to the point where you get a kind of Stockholm syndrome effect, and they just punch their ticket for change and take a chance.
I think that's right. I think that there is a certain amount of that. You know, I mean, it always is the impulse just to quote unquote throw the bums out, right, when things aren't going your way. And, you know, this is one of the reasons, you know, I have been, you know, yelling about the Tea Party from the minute it was born, and progressives were being dismissive about it. Well, you know, sooner or later, people throw whomever is in power out, and we have a two-party system. And if the Republican Party goes further to the right, then that's who you get. So, I mean, I do think that there is, there's definitely a potential for the scenario that you're describing. And I think that there is outrage fatigue, too. And I think we see that. It's funny, the media has definitely jumped on the financial aspect of the Romney story, the missing Bain years and the tax returns. But, you know, the media were very sedate about all of the race baiting we've seen in the last couple of weeks. You know, the Sununu comments about Obama not being a real American just sort of, you know, he got away with it, basically. You know, he issued a very de facto.
Right, just a heated comment in a moment of unbridled passion, yes. So again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, the Washington Bureau Chief of Alternet. Now, just back to the beam me up category here.
Right.
I just wonder why it is that something more can't be made of this flagrant hypocrisy. The Republicans are insisting that Democrats who vote have to jump through hoops to show their identity, but billionaires who are buying the election don't have to disclose who they are. What country is that? Tell me where that kind of insanity would be operating.
You know, that's a really, really great comparison, and I must say, not one that I had, you know, really thought of myself. So, you know, maybe you should be doing some messaging for the Democrats. You know what I'm saying? I mean, a lot of it is also messaging issues on, you know, among Democrats that they just don't, you know, they just don't put those kinds of messages out there in a really strong way. I mean, that would be a great television ad. And what kind of country is it? Well, it's kind of a scary country, and I do think that things are, you know, I don't mean to be a downer, Debbie Downer, but I'm beginning to get fearful. I really am about, you know, between the race baiting and the voter ID laws and the absolute, you know, denial of the amount of undisclosed money in the system. I just did a big investigation about Ralph Reed, and, you know, his setup is astonishing, where he's got this 501c4 nonprofit called the Faith and Freedom Coalition, yet these donors, these mega donors, can give as much as they want to without being disclosed, and then Ralph Reed's for-profit gets the business. You know, a Faith and Freedom Coalition contracts with his for-profit consulting firm. I mean, it's just so filthy, the whole system, and it's legal.
Well, I remember during the time of Ken Lay and Enron that Ralph Reed had written to Enron and offered his services to them. This is this incredible Ponzi scheme that was operating. And his letters to them were so craven and disgusting, you know, that telling them what he would do. And this is a good Christian, you know. I mean, he doesn't, obviously, he's so Christian that he doesn't mind dealing with crooks, you know.
Well, yeah, and, you know, and this is, but, and he's just one of a bunch of these guys, right? Mm. Who've been working on getting the system rigged in their favor now for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. And, you know, the amount of structural damage they've done to our political system is going to take a very, very long time and a sustained period of leadership that is willing to make change in order to fix. And I just don't really see that in the offing.
Well, I'm going to have to beam you out now.
Yeah, Debbie Downer. Be gone with you, Debbie Downer.
And thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks,
Adele.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, the Washington Bureau Chief for Alternet.org, where she covers Beltway politics. Her work has appeared in The New Republic, The Village Voice, The Nation, Salon.com, and Mother Jones, as well as on the op-ed pages of The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, The San Francisco Chronicle, and The New York Daily News. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the double standard with terrorism.
There's a place I don't. The edge of town, sir, rising above the factories and the fields. Ever since I was a child, I can remember the mansion on the hill.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeremiah Gorka, who writes about the politics and culture of security. From 2007 to 2010, he was an analyst at the RAND Corporation, where he conducted research for the U.S. military and was the lead author of The Mujahideen al-Haq in Iraq, A Policy Conundrum. He was also a member of a research team that helped to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a staffer on the Congressional Mandated Military Leadership Diversity Commission, and an attorney with the United States Department of Justice. He has an op-ed at the American Prospect, Caught in a Bad Alliance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremiah Gorka.
Thanks so much, Ian. I'm glad to be back.
And clearly we have examples of their sort of terrorism as opposed to our sort of terrorism in the world today. By that I mean we've seen that a terrorist bomb killed three of Assad's top leaders, and there aren't too many people in the West that are losing tears over it, but terrorism is terrorism. And then now we have a bus being attacked in Bulgaria, killing a bunch of Israeli tourists. The Israeli Prime Minister and Defense Minister pinned that on Iran, with Hezbollah operating at the behest of Iran. And then you, of course, have studied a group of Iranian terrorists who are a lot of conservatives in this country want to, you know, be best friends with and take them off the terrorist list. So walk us through some of this gray area, if you will.
Well, terrorism is always a political definition. It's always hard to define. You have some people saying the sort of classic line that one person's terrorist is another's freedom fighter. But I think it's right to start with a general condemnation of violence in general, particularly against civilians. I mean, what we have in Syria, it looks like a terrorist tactic in a civil war, whereas what we have with the Mujahideen al-Haq is a group that was doing terrorist attacks for over decades against the Shah's government and then against the current Islamic regime. They stopped in 2001, or at least they said they did, and have been since then trying to get lots of attention in the United States and lots of allies among the leaders for the purpose of getting them off of the Foreign Terrorist Organization list. That's sort of their primary goal. It's a group that has been illegal in the United States since 1997. They've succeeded in getting off of the terrorist lists in Europe and the UK. The importance of this on one front is simply fundraising. It's illegal for them to raise funds. Once they get off of it, they can raise more funds for their goal. And the goal of the Mujahideen al-Haq is to become the new government of Iran. And so they are trying to get the U.S. They deny it, but they're basically working hard to push the U.S. into a war footing with Iran, and it seems that they have some degree of action in Israel. And as we can see, they're sort of a friend of my, enemy of my enemy is my friend. This seems to be going on both here and in Israel, vis-a-vis Iran. It's really kind of frustrating seeing how, for instance, in the response to the Burgas bombing, the first thing that the Israeli leadership says is that it was Iran's fault before we can really know exactly what happened. I mean, this seems to be the usual approach when terrorism happens. We automatically blame it on someone and then sort of later on let the facts actually shake out. yeah, I still remember listening after the Oklahoma City bombing, and everyone immediately assumed it was an Arab terrorist and started throwing off all sorts of racist epithets on the radio, and then we find out that it was actually an American guy. So it's a time to pause, because what the MEK is trying to do and what so many other folks are trying to do is create this war footing, or at least massive sort of threat of war, that is good politics for some people. I mean, I find it interesting that on the same day that the Burgas bombing happened, the unity government crumbled in Israel, and so now Netanyahu's party has a very slim majority. It's standard political practice for political groups that are feeling threatened to play boogeyman politics and basically get rally their troops and their people behind a perceived threat. The MEK has been doing this constantly in the United States. They're the ones who first put the Iranian possible nuclear weapons program into the public eye, and they have been pushing that and pushing that and pushing that very effectively, not alone, but definitely in kind of a coincidence of interests with other folks who I think are interested in at least maintaining a threat of war with Iran. They've maintained this sort of steady narrative. So despite the fact that basically all officials in the U.S. and Israel and Iran all say that Iran does not have an ongoing nuclear weapons program, a huge majority of the American public, that's been rated as high as 88%, thinks that there is an ongoing weapons program. And, well, that's done a pretty good job of raising fears.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeremiah Gorka, who writes about the politics and culture of security, and we're talking about how one man's terrorist, I guess, is another man's freedom fighter, and the extent to which a terrorist group that has a lot of support in conservative circles here in the United States, particularly amongst the neoconservatives, and they, of course, are all the advisors for Mitt Romney. I noticed that when Mitt Romney was asked in December if he'd ever heard of the MEK, he said he'd never heard of them. I guess that might have a lot more to do with his apparent detachment from foreign policy, which I think he's going to pretty much outsource. But
so to speak, certainly seems that way.
Right. But the article that you've written in the American Prospect, Jeremiah Gorka, Caught in a Bad Alliance, you point out that and we noticed this just recently, that Newt Gingrich was seen bowing before this Iranian dissident terrorist group, their cult-like leader, Rajavi, and then the Chicago Tribune columnist Clarence Page got him in a lot of trouble because he took a $30,000 fee and was flown over to Paris to address the same conference that Newt Gingrich came to pay his respects to. But they're joining a long list, a bipartisan list of people who are working on behalf of the MEK to take them off the U.S. terrorist list. And that list includes former Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, former Homeland Security Advisor Francis Townsend, former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and former Vermont Governor Howard Dean. All of these have received, in some cases, $30,000 for speaking before this group. So this is kind of either tells you, one, that the MEK have a lot of money and know how to spend it, but maybe it tells you how easy it is to buy our politicians.
Well, it's interesting. I my last piece that I wrote about them, about some of the folks who are taking money, and for clarity, I should probably mention, on one end, it's just that was the $30,000 price is just per speech, and a lot of people have given several. And Clarence Page is a rare one here to have returned the money after or before he got into some trouble for it. A friend of mine who I was speaking with, who is fairly well connected on the Republican sides, took issue with me, and I realized that in part my argument was that the reason why people were taking this type of money, they couldn't be bought for this little $30,000 for people who are leaving government, who must be having huge salaries now, that a lot of these folks have their own security consultancies who would very likely benefit from the public trough if there's a war with Iran. And his response was, No, I don't think so. I think they probably could get bought off for $30,000. that is, it's sort of appalling. Sort of humorously, on the flip side, the MEK has alleged that the people who criticize it are taking far larger sums from the Iranian government. And I can say I certainly have not been offered any large sum of money to speak about this topic.
But my understanding is that, I don't know how closely the MEK works with Israel, but my understanding is that they've been providing the Israelis with a lot of the so-called intelligence about Iran's nuclear program. I'm not sure whether they've been directly connected to assassinations that have taken place of Iranian nuclear scientists. But if the accusations against Iran are correct about the bombing of the Israeli tourists in Bulgaria, there's now some doubts about who did it. There was an initial claim by the Bulgarians that a Swedish terrorist who had spent time at Guantanamo was involved. That's been denied by the U.S., but the long and the short of it is that if it is blowback, give me a sense of how much the MEK is involved, to your knowledge, helping the Israelis and providing information to both the Israelis and the United States.
Well, if it's, I have a hard time imagining that the Iranian government would have ordered something like this at a time of such intense saber rattling. There's the next round of Iranian nuclear program talks coming up next week Israel apparently canceling leaves for the defense force regarding what's going on in Syria. Iran backing away from Syria a little bit. It's so fraught that it seems to me that would have just been a very foolish thing to do, although that fits the narrative of people trying to make it seem like the Iranian regime is crazy, which I think is an argument to just make it them against them having a nuclear weapons program. It's very much like a Cold War trope about the crazy Soviets. But it would be possible that maybe Hezbollah, an Iranian-supported group, chose to do this as some blowback on its own. Possible. It's an interesting question whether the MEK was indeed involved in the assassinations of the Iranian nuclear scientists. I mean, there's arguments saying that's happened. Some folks have said it was Israel on its own in a new book. I don't personally know the answer on it. What I do find two things really interesting here, though. One is that a lot of the people who support the MEK among the neoconservatives, out of one side of their mouth, say it's because they're all democratic. On the other side of their mouth, seems to support, like the fact that they have this history of violence and could easily return to it. The other, I think I forgot what my other point was. I would like to touch on something you said earlier, though, about Romney and his advisors. It's definitely true that a lot of his advisors are big fans of the MEK. You have John Bolton, you have Mitchell Rice, and former Attorney General Mukasey, and others. You know, for Romney, who has no foreign policy experience, his sort of tactic here seems to be to act even more hawkish than Obama, who's clearly a pretty hawkish president, and so surround himself with the hawks in his part in the Republican Party to placate them. It could just be kind of a gang of rivals sort of approach, but it also could mean that he'd be very, a President Romney might be very likely to want to listen to some of these former officials. And Bolton, for instance, who claims not to take money from the MEK, and his speeches, if you listen to them, to the MEK events, are very, very tailored, I think, to keep him safe in future confirmation hearings, that he doesn't say too much about the MEK, but he does lay it down very clearly that he is an absolute supporter of regime change fast.
Well, just in closing, Jeremiah Gorka, what's your sense of the what's going on in Syria in terms of terrorism being used against the regime? There's no question in the world that the Syrian Assad regime are some of the most brutal thugs that ever controlled a country, and they're using criminal groups, the so-called Shabia, to terrorize and murder and torture people across the country, and they seem to have absolutely no compunctions. And they may well resort to using their chemical weapons arsenal against their own people. But on the other hand, you know, terrorist bombs are being used against this regime, and I don't see any much condemnation coming from the West. And also, there's a lot of condemnation now of Russia and China for their veto today of the resolution to get tougher on the Assads. But of course, the U.S. has routinely vetoed condemnations of Israel hundreds of times. So give me, just in closing, give me a sense of this apparent inconsistency.
I think that when you look at Syria, it looks a lot like a modern version of the Great Game. It's U.S. versus Russia versus China, operating through proxies, using proxy forces, trying to reach for different types of resources. The hypocrisy is amazing when we read what our complaints about Russia having a military base in Syria and selling weapons to Syria and, getting oil from Syria, as if that's not exactly what we would want to do and what we wanted to do in Libya. And we did. And one of the reasons why Russia is being somewhat recalcitrant, it seems, at least recalcitrant against our interests in Syria, is because this is so similar to, there's so many parallels with what happened in Libya. And I think that Russia feels burned by what happened to it, to its interests in Libya, and it lost billions of dollars of weapons contracts, for instance. I'm just waiting until a no-fly zone is created for Syria. I feel awful for Syrians. They're caught between that. They're caught between big powers who I think are kind of playing with them, and an awful, absolutely awful tyrant government that's been helped be propped up, and just terrible violence in the country. There's nothing good here.
Well, Jeremiah Gorka, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeremiah Gorka, who writes about the politics and culture of security. From 2007 to 2010, he was an analyst at the RAND Corporation, where he conducted research on the U.S. for the U.S. military, and was the lead author of The Mujahideen al-Haq in Iraq, A Policy Conundrum. He was also a member of the research team that helped to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a staffer on the congressionally mandated Military Leadership Diversity Commission, and an attorney with the United States Department of Justice. He has an op-ed at The American Prospect, Caught in a Bad Alliance.
And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the worst drought since 1956 that's caused the price of corn to go up 50% in the last 4 weeks. And then we'll also talk about the geopolitics of drought globally. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tony Vinn, who's a professor and cropping systems extension agronomist in the Department of Agronomy at Purdue University. He has served as extension coordinator for the agronomy department at Purdue and as associate editor for Agronomy Journal, Crop Science, and Soil and Tillage Research. He has been the co-chair of the Indiana Crop Advisory Conference since 2003. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tony Vinn.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you and your listeners.
So already, in addition to the 1,300 counties across 29 states that have been designated by the United States Department of Agriculture as a natural disasters area, just on Wednesday, the Secretary of Agriculture, Mr. Vilsack, added 39 counties and 8 more states as natural disaster areas. Where does it stand where you are? You're really right in the middle of the Corn Belt, aren't you?
Yes. Indiana happens to be in the center part of the drought disaster area, in quotes, in the eastern Corn Belt. And we have 92 counties in Indiana, and at last count, at least 55 of those were in the so-called disaster category.
So we have corn way up now in the last few months, up 60%. And then you have on top of that, as you've mentioned, the competing uses for what's left. There's been no spillover from last year, or a little spillover from last year. So you said that the ethanol people might get first grab at it, as opposed to the people, the feed for cattle and for fattening, for food, for meat, etc. Are those things determined by politics or agribusiness or what?
Well, the renewable fuel standard essentially mandates a certain level of ethanol use. And that level of ethanol use today has involved an annual usage of 4.9 billion bushels of corn. The good news is, of course, that approximately one-third of the weight of corn going into ethanol is a valuable byproduct that is used in the livestock industry as dry distiller's grain, which is a very important protein supplement. So ethanol's use is not entirely lost to the livestock industry. But it is fair to say that the mandate is accounting for a increasing percentage of the expected corn crop in 2012. And so one of the major questions, perhaps, that politicians will need to address is, number one, should the mandate for the renewable fuel standard be left unchanged, considering, you know, the competing uses for livestock feed, for exports, as well as for other domestic uses. And one of the factors that will also have to be considered is whether the fuel blenders have any flexibility to perhaps use credits that they've built up in terms of making more ethanol than they were mandated to in previous years. And so if they were to apply credits, if the blenders were to apply credits from previous years, then there might be some, perhaps a 20% reduction in the amount of grain corn that would need to go into ethanol in the 2012-13 marketing year.
Again, I'm speaking with Tony Vinn, a professor and cropping systems extension agronomist in the Department of Agronomy at Purdue University. He serves as extension coordinator for the agronomy department at Purdue and an associate editor for Agronomy Journal, Crop Science, and Soil and Tillage Research. He's been the co-chair of the Indiana Crop Advisory Conference since 2003. So, Tony Vinn, tell me though, for the consumer, what does this mean if the price of corn's already in the last 4 weeks has gone up 50%. How's it going to impact the consumer later in the year in terms of what they'll be buying for food on the table?
The agricultural economists that I've heard address this topic have estimated that it means at least a 5% increase in the price of food from what we knew with the projections based on the last crop yield estimate from USDA, which is based on 146 bushel per acre corn crop. The corn is just a very important feed ingredient for pigs, poultry, dairy, beef, you name it. In the short run, I think that price increases for some products are more likely than they are for other products. For instance, if livestock farmers decide that they cannot afford the feed or they don't have the feed available to keep their herd size as large as it is today, then in the short run, meat products could be cheaper because a herd reduction might lead to more slaughtering. But in the long term, of course, that would result in a price increase, because once herd size is reduced, then that automatically will reduce meat supplies in the future. But there are many, many items in the grocery store today that have corn as an ingredient. And because the presence of corn is so pervasive, not only for meat and milk and egg products, but also in so many other cereal food items, sugars, etc., and syrups, we essentially are estimated today that we will face at least a 5% increase in food costs because of the damage that has been done by the drought combined with the heat thus far in 2012.
Well, just in closing, Tony Vinn, obviously higher food prices are going to happen, and this is happening at a time when the world economy is weak, as is the U.S. economy. In some parts of the world, there's an expectation that this will lead to political instability. In many ways, a lot of analysts have said that the Arab Spring was propelled in many ways by the unsustainable and unaffordable rises in food prices that led people to take to the streets. What's your understanding of the global impact of food shortage? Because I understand that as the drought is deepening here in the United States, there's also problems in Russia, Ukraine, and Australia in terms of crop yields.
It is extremely important that we, in food-producing nations, devote more resources to the issue of food security, because if we don't, we will not only fail to meet the needs of the populations that we have today, but we will be coming up short more often at the growth in population that's expected to take place by the year 2050, and we will not be able to meet the changing diets of people who naturally aspire to diet improvements when income levels are changing in their homes and in their families. Food security, an investment in food security, is the issue in terms of spending priorities for research, in terms of spending priorities for education. And if we don't take this crisis as a wake-up call to how thin our production actually is compared to the annual need, if we don't remove ourselves from the complacency that there will always be enough food in the grocery store, whether here in the United States or in African countries, if we don't get away from the complacency, then we will be in a much worse situation geopolitically as well than the unrest that has been experienced in recent years, or the unrest and the discomfort that could occur partially in response to this. So I think that we need to understand that investments in stability and resiliency of crop production in the face of climate change, in the face of less and less land being that is suitable for crop production, being available to crop production because of competing uses, we simply need not only to retain our best land for crop production, we need to engage more scientists in understanding how to improve both water use efficiency and nutrient use efficiency in our crop systems to guarantee food security for the future. And to me, the overall geopolitical issue is not just a short-term focus on food security, but a very much increased emphasis on long-term food security, whether it's here in the developing world or in the developed world. In both places, the national priority has to be on food security. And to the extent that we do that, we'll be able to better meet the needs of tomorrow's citizens.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Tony Venn, and I hope this happens, and I hope we have a serious debate about it, but there's a lot of global warming denial, even in amongst our politicians, so that's going to be a tough road to hoe.
There is no denial about climate variability, and so I view the whole aspect of what's happening in terms of resiliency to temperature and precipitation fluctuations that are more extreme than what we've witnessed in the past. I view this whole aspect of not only crop variety selection, but crop management decisions and soil quality improvement considerations to try to have a enhanced yield as well as enhanced stability of yield in the face of climate variability as just being extremely important.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Tony Venn.
You're very welcome, sir. It's been my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Tony Venn, who's a professor in cropping systems, extension agronomist in the Department of Agronomy at Purdue University. He served as extension coordinator for the agronomy department at Purdue and as associate editor for Agronomy Journal, Crop Science, and Soil and Tillage Research. He has been the co-chair of the Indiana Crop Advisory Conference since 2003. Let's now turn to Eric Holtz-Jimenez, who's the Executive Director of Food First and the Institute for Food and Development Policy. He's the editor of Food Movements Unite, Strategies to Transform Our Food Systems, and the author of Food Rebellions, Crisis and the Hunger for Justice. He has worked with farmers and participated in their farmer-to-farmer training, created innovative farming methods, raised yields, and improved livelihoods for hundreds of thousands of small farmers and their families. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Holtz-Jimenez.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
And we were just talking about the drought here in the United States, the worst since 1956. It's caused the price of corn to go up by over 50% in the last 4 weeks. There is, of course, a global dimension here with the Ukraine, Russia, and Australia facing similar droughts. How is this going to impact the rest of the world? There are some countries, for example, like Yemen, that are in a very unstable food situation at the moment, facing famine. A country like Egypt that's just have a revolution that is by no means settled. They're the world's largest importer of wheat. So do you think there's going to be ripple effects here beyond the fact that here in the United States we're going to have to pay 5% more for our food?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that there are going to be a number of very perverse effects because of the way our global food system works. It doesn't mean that there's not going to be enough food for everybody, but it does mean that prices are going to skyrocket, and those who will be affected most will be the poor. And it also means, for example, that countries that are land poor or water poor are going to continue to engage in land grabs around the world in order to try and avoid the global market, because that's where this is going to impact the most, is the global market. And, you know, we're going to see some of the same disturbing trends that we've seen in 2008 and 2011. I think that, the problem here is not the drought. I mean, I'm not a climate change denier at all, but the fact is that we've always had droughts different times. The problem is that the world food system is controlled by monopolies, and most of the grain from those monopolies comes out of the countries you just mentioned, the United States and Australia and whatnot. And so the global north is producing all this grain. And as long as when the global north's grain itself is under tension from drought, and then the rest of the world has to suffer. You know, back in the 70s, the rest of the world produced their own food. In fact, the third world used to produce a surplus of about $1 billion of food each year. That's since been reversed, and now they are net importers of food and very much dependent upon the food coming out of the United States and other parts of the north. So, yeah, I mean, the other thing that's going to happen, of course, is that fuel prices are going to go up, because now, you know, 40% of our corn crop in this country goes to fuel. And so what was, you know, people thought that ethanol was such a great idea, but they didn't count on droughts, did they? So now fuel prices are going to go up because of the fact that we cut it with ethanol.
So do you think then that, I mean, I guess what you're saying here, to paraphrase, is that neoliberal programs like NAFTA have changed the nature of how many countries in the world, and particularly in the third world, were food self-sufficient. And now they've basically been hooked on American agribusiness. And if American agribusiness has a bad year, they starve.
Well, precisely. And they starve not because there's not enough food. Again, they starve because the price of food goes up and then they can't afford to buy it. I mean, what we're talking about is the corporate food regime. And it's an extremely vulnerable regime. And it's highly vulnerable to both environmental and economic shock. And the two interact, of course. And this has to do with the tremendous monopoly concentration that we have, and the tremendous concentration that we have with crops and varieties. You know, most 90% of the cropland of industrial agriculture is dedicated to just five different crops. And there's just a handful of varieties within those crops. So that means that we're extremely vulnerable to environmental shock. And also, this allows the tremendous market power on the part of the monopolies that control the seeds, that control the grain, you know, Monsanto, Syngenta, Cargill, ADM, et cetera. And of course, on the retail side as well. So anyway, what will happen, of course, is that prices will go up and these monopolies will make record profits again, as they did in 2011 and as they did in 2008 when we had the food crises. And so it'll concentrate even more wealth and power within those monopolies. So I think that the problem isn't, though of course climate change is a problem, droughts are a problem, we would be much more resilient as a global food system if our system was much more diversified and countries were allowed to grow their own food. You're precisely right. The free trade agreements are a part of the corporate food regime. Those agreements have destroyed farmers' economies around the world and made those countries dependent on our farmers, and now our farmers aren't going to be able to deliver.
But you've also said, Eric Jimenez, that what we grow is a distortion. There are only a few crops, and my understanding is that much of the corn, as you mentioned, goes to ethanol, but a lot goes to cattle feed, pork, and poultry. And then you have this ubiquitous product called high fructose corn syrup that's in just about every food that you buy in the supermarket. And that's one of the direct causes of obesity in this country.
And around the world.
And around the world, yeah. And so you can make the case, can't you, that corporate food is killing us?
Yeah, well, I think that we have an especially lethal combination now, which is, it's not just the food itself, it's the whole food regime, because we have to look at the entire value chain. But that in combination with the climate changes, which this regime has provoked, is lethal. And until we begin to support the alternatives, which would be to diversify our food system and to move away from these patented seeds and begin to support local land races and move away from a seed-oriented approach to adaptation or climate mitigation and move towards an agroecological approach, which actually builds resiliency into the entire farm system, not just into one seed. It's much quicker and much easier for most of the world to adopt. Until we move towards these types of things, I think that we're going to continue to see these crises. And I think that with each crisis, these monopolies become more powerful and simply tighten their stranglehold on the world's food and fuel supply.
But you can't really bring back the family farm as much as it sounds like the solution.
Well, I don't know why not. I mean, in fact, that's the only sector which is growing around the world today, including the United States. The fastest growing sector in the United States are small farms. Now, these are very small farms, and most of them can't provide for an entire complete livelihood for the family. We need to address the land question in this country. We need to address the question of concentration. I mean, as we speak, land is concentrating in the Midwest, and it's going to concentrate a lot more after this drought, and a lot of farmers go bankrupt. And unless we reverse that concentration, I think that, you know, we really have some major disasters ahead. And, you know, while we've been able to shove most of these disasters off on the rest of the world, the chickens are coming home to roost, and we're going to be experiencing them here as well.
Well, I guess what we're getting to now is how do you reverse corporate power in this country and corporate control? Because, I mean, you know, I'd love to see more family farms, but if the monopolies control it, how do you break the monopolies? How do you break corporate power? That's a long conversation, right?
Right. There's not just one answer to that, of course. One thing could be we might consider applying our antitrust laws in this country. That would be
what a concept.
one step. Yeah,
applying the law.
Well, Eric, the law that actually exists.
Right.
And then, of course, we could bring back some laws to break up these trusts.
Yeah.
But in order to do that, we need strong movements. And you've mentioned our last book, Food Movements Unite. In fact, that's what we need. We need the different social movements, and particularly the food movements and other movements, to create the political pressure and the political will for the structural changes that we need in this country. We need agriculture out of the WTO. We need to scrap this farm bill. Farm bill in history is going through Congress now.
Sure. I'm sorry to tell you that we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Eric Holt Jimenez, the Executive Director of Food First and the Institute for Food and Development Policy. And we are, just before I leave here today, I'll be back on Sunday, of course. I want to again invite you to the UCLA HEMA Forum that I'm hosting this Tuesday, July the 24th at 7:30 p.m. on drones and robotic warfare. Well, I'll have three of the leading experts on the civilian uses of drone, the advancement of robotic technology, and the ethical issues and implications. Again, this coming Tuesday, 24th of July, 7:30 p.m. at the UCLA HEMA Forum in Westwood, free to the public. Join me there. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.